we're back with another episode of Anarcho Book Club. So today we're just going to cover a small portion of the book we've been reading. And that book is On Language by Noam Chomsky. And we're just reading the first work in this book called Language and Responsibility. I think in the last episode I might have called it something different, like Language and Politics or something like that. But I was misinformed by my own mind because I just read the first section of it, or the title of the first section. So today we're talking about Language and Responsibility by Noam Chomsky. And you can find this book, if you haven't read it yet, we're still going through it, and I have a feeling this is going to be more than two episodes. This may be three episodes, because this book is very dense. Just this first chapter was extremely dense, and which is a good thing, actually. It's a good thing that Mr. Chomsky, he explains things in great detail that I would not have... that I haven't seen from a lot of other authors. So we're just going to work through the first part of it, and that has to do a lot with systems of ideological control and indoctrination through mass media. And although this part of the book was written in 1977, or at least it was published in 1977, there are a lot of things in it that apply directly to our world today. He almost was a Nostradamus of his time, of our time, I guess, because he was able to predict... Well, no, I don't think he actually even predicted the mass surveillance system that... or mass surveillance systems that we see today in today's world. I think he saw it being developed even back before his time in the... around World War I and II, these systems were being developed. Even before that, all of these systems were being developed. This system of ideological control. And it kind of gave me a new perspective on everything, on history in general, which is what I think maybe he was trying to give us, a new perspective. But let's just dive into it. And I have a bunch of notes, so if I sound a bit distracted on occasion, it's because I'm reading over my notes. And I am not, well, I'll put it this way, I tend to be fairly verbose whenever writing down notes, even though that's kind of defeats the purpose of notes. But I don't want to miss anything, so... But the first point that we see is precisely this, the idea... of a system of ideological control being formed. And something that he mentions is he starts speaking about the intelligentsia, and that is the college professors of his time and of ours, the people who we look at and see as experts, be they experts such as doctors or experts such as sociological experts. Or linguistic, in his case, experts. Or mathematics experts, which he mentions later. And how they're put on a pedestal by our mass media, be it the newspapers, which were in his time more prominent than they are now, or be it in today's world, the large media platforms like CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, all of these large media corporations that are all private and all for-profit institutions. And he says when addressing these institutions, specifically I think he even addressed the Washington Post as a mouthpiece for the powers that be, the leaders in Washington, D.C. He tells us that the ordinary skeptic... in his words, ordinary skepticism and application is sufficient to delve into the depths of political sociological studies. You don't need a PhD in sociology to delve into these depths. In fact, I think he might even argue, and I think he does argue, that will skew your interpretation of your studies in the political sociological field. And he goes on to talk about the intelligentsia, the people who, the mass media, the government, the major corporations, or minor corporations for that matter, hold up and set up as the experts, the people who we should all trust, who we should all know. This is something that we are all pretty familiar with in today's day and age. These experts in the field of, well, at this time, experts in the field of health, experts in the field of sociological management, experts in the field of morality, as it were. I see a lot of people today, a lot of ministers in the United States and quote-unquote religious experts speaking on morality in today's day and age. And these people should always be approached with a certain amount of skepticism, because they are the mouthpiece of those that would control us. For instance, and I know this may be a little bit odd to hear, but even they have held up a certain individual in the United States, at least, as sort of a expert in the field, part of the intelligentsia, Dr. I don't know his first name, so we'll just go with Dr. Fauci. And I'm not saying you should take what he says and throw it out the window, because I would never say that about anyone who may be an expert in their own field. However, I think what Chomsky is urging us to do is, whenever someone comes to the table and says this is absolute and this is truth, it is healthy to have a bit of skepticism, especially if they came directly from the bowels of the intelligentsia, from the bowels of the government that seeks to oppress its own citizens, from the depths, from the dregs of this thing that we call intelligent civilization. And you see him up there talking, and you see him contradict himself time and time again on everything that he says is absolute truth. In the beginning of the outbreak of this worldwide pandemic, they claimed absolutely that no masks would be necessary. They claimed with absolute certainty that we would only have to lock down for 14 days. And of course, those absolute truths changed. And I'm not saying at this point that certain things were not necessary to for you as an individual to remain safe, and for you and your community to remain safe. However, whenever someone presents you with an absolute truth, you're listening to me now. If I tell you something is an absolute truth, which I hope I never do with the same sense of assuredness that I've seen from all of these people in the intelligentsia that are talking to us of these matters, but whenever someone tells you something is absolutely true, instantly you may want to approach that with some sort of a measured skepticism, because it may not be as absolute as they're claiming, or as they think it is. Because I don't doubt that the intelligentsia do think that what they're saying is absolutely true. I don't doubt that. Or if they do doubt the truth of their claims, I don't doubt that they think that this is for the best. And he goes on to talk about the professional intelligentsia, because he talks about how it is useful to protect the apparatus of social control in any given society. His specific concern is the United States and the role that what he says is the professional intelligentsia. That would be the professors, the experts, the expert witnesses, the experts that are in control of government, the experts that are in control of, say, Walmart or Google or Facebook. They all serve to protect that apparatus of social control. Just think about it. Think about Facebook, for instance. I haven't been on Facebook for years. I had an account until recently, but I hadn't visited that account for years and years. But think about the amount of social control that they can wield. And it's not direct. It's not by, I've seen a lot of claims from kind of the right-wing side of things that they're being shut down, their Facebook groups are being spied upon. And just as a side note here, I think it's kind of funny that they would be so outraged by that. They're given a platform for free, by the way, which costs millions of dollars to maintain. And they're given this platform for free, and it makes me wonder, what did they think was going to happen? Those in the free software world already knew these things would happen. We already knew that if something like this, like Facebook, is given to you for free, there's nothing free about it. Not in the sense of freedom as we understand in the free software movement. There's not a single thing about Facebook that could be considered free, except for it is free as in free beer. But even then, you're paying with a currency that you may not know about. It's the currency of your data. It's the currency of your privacy. It's the currency that is worth more than any currency out there on the market today. It's worth more than Bitcoin, even, which is hitting all record highs today as I speak. It's so valuable to them. And why is it so valuable? This Facebook and Twitter and all of these different platforms are valuable because it provides a transport for this apparatus of social control, for the intelligentsia to control to control the minds of those that it claims to serve. And this social control apparatus, if you think it just came about with the United States, you would be mistaken, gravely, gravely mistaken. This social control apparatus is as old as humankind. It's as old as governments, as old as religion, which is as old as humankind as we know it today. It can be clearly seen in ancient Egypt, of all places. If you look back millennia ago and you see the structures built by ancient Egypt or ancient Egyptians, you see these temples. And these temples serve to inform the population, or at least to inform the leaders of a given population, to inform them on matters that allow the maintainers and the intelligentsia, as it were, of these temples to enforce a sort of social control upon a given population. And then you scroll forward away from ancient Egypt. They fall. Their whole society kind of crumbles for a while and then slowly rises back. But as it rises up, there you have nations like Babylon, or you have nations like ancient Rome or ancient Greece. And each one of these, they have their own apparatuses of social control. And they are all run by the intelligentsia. And they are informed and controlled by those that would seek power, those that would have and hold power. And all of this is done through indoctrination via the mode of mass media. And in today's world, that would be Facebook, Twitter, Parler, if you're on that. It's all these forms of mass media that are controlled by some sort of a corporation, which in turn is controlled by the government. But whenever I say government here, I don't think I mean something like the United States federal government. What I mean by that is it's as Chomsky said, the intelligentsia. It is those at the top who have the power at their disposal, and they don't even have, it doesn't even have to be the president of the United States, at least not here. It could be anyone, the director of the FBI, the director of the CIA. And this all sounds very conspiratorial, perhaps. But I would put forth that maybe the reason why, if you hear this and you think, Harag has gone off the deep end now. Just think about it. Think about, and maybe this is the argument that a conspiracy theorist would make. But think about just the idea of that word, conspiracy. What it has come to mean in the context, well, in any context that it is placed in. Conspiracy sounds bad almost immediately to you. It's something that you have learned that it means something similar to someone who believes in these things, these conspiracy theories, like aliens pulling people up and probing them or whatever. These people are crazy, right? You've come to believe that these people are crazy. You've come to see that these people have some form of schizophrenia or some mind-distorting sickness. But in reality, it is easily seen and clearly seen. In fact, Chomsky has shown in this book on language, if you read both Language and Responsibility and Reflections on Language, you will see he lays out very plainly. And if you've been reading along, you'll see he lays out very plainly and how bluntly and how obvious it is that those that would be in power, and it doesn't even have to be someone in government, in the United States government. It could be someone like the CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai. Or it could be the CEO of Facebook. It could be any of these people who exert this control over a given population. And he lays this all out pretty well. And then he goes on to kind of point out that professional credentials do not permit dissenting opinions. And this is an underlying, and he should know, he was deep within this. He still is deep within this apparatus in the universities. If you have a professional credential, say a PhD, at least in his time, even in this time, there is a measure of control exerted over people with such credentials to keep them all in a cohesive, tight group, parroting the same doctrines. And it's not as nefarious as some might make it out to be. Or no, it is more nefarious, I guess, but it's not as blatant and obvious. No one's, as far as I know, no one is having their life threatened or what have you. It's more of a social pressure. It's control through language, which is what this whole thing is about. It's what Chomsky is talking about. Control through language, through sociological pressure, through peer pressure, in other words. And if you don't believe the right things, it's not as if you're going to be fired from your job as a professor at MIT or Stanford or wherever you are teaching or professing. It's not as if you would be fired. There's nothing so bold and blatant as that. It's more you'll be shunned by your peers, because everyone else buys into this, to the same version of history. Everyone else buys into the same version of sociology. And if you have a dissenting voice, well, you'll be excluded. You'll be excluded from publishing, although Chomsky has done a pretty good job of getting his books published. But you'll be excluded from so many different avenues. And Chomsky even mentions that up until the point of publication here in 1977, he was never asked by any mainstream news organizations or newspapers or magazines to give an interview or to discuss his own dissenting opinions. His own dissenting opinions on Vietnam. And he goes into that as well. He goes into Vietnam, which at the time was one of the big issues, and the student movement to fight against that. Because it didn't come from the professors, it came from the students who observed the attack on Vietnam, and they organized and rallied against it. And maybe a lot of them didn't even know what they were fighting for, what they were marching against. Maybe a lot of them were joining because of social pressure or for some sort of a status symbol, which I think happens a lot more than most movements would like to admit. But they organized against the Vietnam War when all of news media, be it a newspaper, a radio show, or a TV show, and all of the universities, or at least the intelligentsia within the universities, were rallying behind the war cry against Vietnam, or rather for what they would call the liberation of the Vietnamese from the communists. And then Chomsky, at this point, when he's talking about this, he gives us his insight into the Vietnam War. He has a kind of an interesting comparison of American journalists being like a sort of a mirror image of, or at least kind of their uniform journaling, as it were, is sort of, it's almost a mirror image of how the Soviet Union controlled all of their media through the publication of Pravda magazine. And he makes this comparison, and although the Soviet Union sort of, they used a method of force to do this, it looks as if the American journalists all did this of their own accord, but really, there was a sort of a, what you might think of as a background static informing their decisions. And this goes back to my example of the Egyptian priests. Those Egyptian priests were a background static, sort of a subliminal message, if you will. And they would inform people through fear, through terror, to believe a certain thing. And it's because you're afraid that you believe these things. It's because you allow yourself to be influenced. And sometimes you don't have a choice but to allow yourself these influences. And you'll buy into whatever you can to remain safe. You buy into whatever's fed to you to remain safe from whatever retribution there may be against you if you don't buy into it. Say, public fear of you, public outcry against you, or it's the idea of the mob mentality rallying against you for whatever it is that you have decided or you have come to believe. And then he goes on to mention Kissinger. And you see, Kissinger was one of the greatest advocates for, or greatest is a bad word to use here. He was one of the most ardent advocates for the war in Vietnam. And he was the national security advisor under Presidents Nixon and Gerald Ford. And his crimes are laid out in a book called The Trial of Henry Kissinger by the great journalist Christopher Hitchens. And Christopher Hitchens is one of the few that I really admire. One of the few journalists, I should say, that I really, really admire for his works. But if you want to read that book, you can. That one, I will not be able to get you for free. So you'll have to buy that one. But Kissinger, he blatantly lied to the American public, but because of the fear, because of the fear-mongering by the public media and by the private media and by the rallying of the media, be it newspaper, radio, or television, the rallying of them plus the rallying of the intelligentsia as a whole around this idea that the United States must free Vietnam from communism. The United States must exert power in order to free another nation from communism. That whole, his true purpose was more to take over, and I think we all sort of know that deep down. It was because the Cold War was, and to a certain extent is, it was a clash between two great powers. And the lines that we are fed, even if you're in Europe, you may have been fed this same propaganda. The propaganda that we were fed was that the United States and its allies were working to free these nations, like Korea or Vietnam or whatever other nations, Germany even. We were working to free them from the controls and the oppression of the Soviet Union. But in fact, that was the furthest thing from the minds of the intelligentsia. And we know this to be true. I mean, it's relatively obvious if you have studied much of any of the Cold War, that in fact it was just a struggle for control over the minds of those that the intelligentsia said that they wanted to free. They wanted to free them from one dictatorship in order to enslave them to another. That is to free them from the dictatorship of communism, of state communism, only to enslave them, to the dictatorship of state capitalism. In communism and capitalism, on their face, as ideas, as ideological systems, there's nothing very evil about either one of them. It's the methods to which they are employed that are evil. And that's why I titled them as state communism and state capitalism. But he goes on to say, with that said, he goes on to say that conformist subservience to power is the end goal. It was the end goal of the attack on Vietnam. And you can even see the depths of depravity on both sides, but especially through Kissinger's attack or his direction of the attack on Vietnam, when even on a day that the American people might claim, especially at that point, as a holy day on Christmas, the Christmas Day bombing, even that day was not sacred to Kissinger and the intelligentsia. Even that day, they went and massacred, I don't even have the numbers in front of me, but massacred so many people, so many individuals, individual minds. And maybe they were fighting for another power, but it doesn't really matter at that point. Because nothing can be accomplished through such shows of force, even if they were telling us the truth, and even if they were intending to free these people, which they weren't. They only intended to enslave these people, these individuals, these individual minds to them instead of to the Soviets. But then, of course, Chomsky goes on to say that the student movement, which opposed this war, which opposed this the show of force by the United States against the Soviet Union, and they opposed it to its very foundation. They didn't just fight against this war. They didn't just fight against the state's complete lack of civil rights for all people, for all individuals. Because at this time, you have to remember as well that the civil rights movement was also taking off and building up. They didn't just fight against those things. They were also fighting against the institutions themselves in the late 60s, starting in the late 60s. And that is the universities to which these students attended. They were fighting against the institutions of power, the structures of power within these institutions, within these universities. They were fighting against the intelligentsia themselves, which is what got them killed in the end. Many of the students were killed in the end. You can hear me turning my notes now, because I have pages. And by this point, we have only gotten 20 pages into the book. It is a 194-page book in the version that I have, but we'll continue. The students even challenged the orthodox economics by challenging the very notion of state capitalism and the political economy. And they wanted to subvert that by just studying the ideals of the political economy and Marx. Which was not allowed. Not really. There would be no classes for it. There would be no member of the intelligentsia that would teach these things to what they might call supple young minds. No, but instead, these students, they formed their own research groups, their own study groups, and studied these things on their own. They came to their universities and they challenged the intelligentsia with their own skepticism. And that's, I believe, in this first part of the book, it is what Chomsky is sort of making a call to action for, to challenge those powers that be. To, if you turn on the news, which I don't very often, but if you do turn on the news and you're hearing a story about anything, really, you have to wonder to yourself, you have to be skeptical of these things, of any kind of world events, and if they say, and the leader of this nation was very benevolent, and so on and so forth, you can look at that with an air of skepticism. Because if things are as Chomsky sees them, then what you see is not always what you get. And I think we all sort of know that deep down. And I think that's what he's trying to say here. And to kind of skip ahead, because I have read ahead, but I haven't prepared any notes, because I would really like to do justice to Chomsky on this. so I'm only going by the notes that I've taken. But to skip ahead a little bit, this all ties back down to language. It ties into language and the use of language. It ties into the type of language that is used. If you've ever noticed a news story breaking and you've watched multiple different channels on this, they all use the same language. And it's a form of, they repeat themselves over and over again. The 24-hour news cycle has been the best thing that has ever happened to the state intelligentsia, to the leaders of these great, these almighty corporations. Because, oh, and not only that, though, but also the formation of things like YouTube and Facebook, where you get 24-hour indoctrination at all times. And not just indoctrination by news agencies, because that is flawed. Because they are not close to you. They're not tied into your own personal community. And so the formation of Facebook was one of the greatest things that ever happened to the intelligentsia. Because now your own friends are telling you that this or that is true. This or that is, this is a great and terrible thing. And it reminds me of the documentary on Netflix. Yes, I have watched things on Netflix, but I look at Netflix with an eye of skepticism at the very foundation of it, because it is closed source, and I'm not one to really trust closed source anything. But there was a documentary on Netflix called The Social Dilemma. I may have mentioned it before, and I look at that documentary with an eye of skepticism because of who produced it. But, and who is hosting it. But, there are good points that are made in that documentary about how our minds can be changed through very subtle means. And one of those means is the order in which you see the content on your Facebook feed. Which, maybe you wouldn't think of it as all that important. But the order in which you see content and what content you see on your Facebook or Twitter feed, it can all be manipulated to help push you into the direction that those in the intelligentsia want you to go. And that brings up another important idea, because you have Facebook, you have Twitter, you have Google, you have the government itself, you have the financial institutions, and you have the educational institutions. And I'm not one to think that they are all unified in their goals, although I sort of do think so because of the language around everything that comes out of all of these institutions. Because it furthers, even though they seem to be challenging, say MSNBC for instance, they seem to be challenging the ideal or the ideas within state capitalism, they help to further it by augmenting it with their own ideas. And Chomsky also talks about this in what I've read so far about Keynesianism, which is a form of state capitalism that seeks to have control over all the markets. It is akin to this sort of ideological control, this sociological control that the state relies on. And you'll see all of this, and then. Chomsky goes into one other point that I thought was really, really interesting. And that is, he says, the American system is primed for a fascist dictatorship by this ideological control. That is the control that we've been talking about. No force, no direct force, is necessary. And that's true. Because if you think about it, if you have a Facebook account, you had to voluntarily sign up for it. Now, there was probably peer pressure, but that's not force, not necessarily. You voluntarily made the choice to give in to that peer pressure and sign up for a Facebook account. And if you have a Facebook account, you have bought into the line, the propaganda that the intelligentsia is trying to sell you. You have taken hold of it, and even if you say you're a skeptic, you're allowing them to feed this to you and affect your subconscious reality with their words, or with their videos, or with their sounds. Well, in that case, listening to this very podcast, you're allowing the same thing. And I do truly hope that I'm not, the only way I'm affecting you is to allow, or to give you the tools to open up your own mind and allow your own interpretation of events or of pieces of data that are inputted or that are being input into your life and into your perspective and into your worldview. And this control, it goes all the way to the top and all the way to the bottom, as we've already said before, because you'll see your mother or father or what have you, your best friend on Facebook, post something that you think, that's just silly. But if you are barraged enough times with information like that, you may not believe that information, but it will flavor your, it will slightly alter your perception of reality. If only maybe it is to alter it to the point where you say that everybody believes this. Because I see it so much, everybody must believe this. I'm the only one that doesn't. That's odd. How odd. I am the odd duck here. And that brings us to challenging the intelligentsia, which is, I think that happened around page 25 or 30. The first person that Chomsky discusses who challenged the intelligentsia, albeit for personal reasons and for personal gain, or maybe to become something like the dictator of the intelligentsia, it was Nixon. Or at least the first person that he talks about in this context was Nixon, because he was condemned for who he targeted, or for whom, I guess it is, he targeted. Not because of the evil methods which he employed in his targeting. He attacked people of power. He challenged their control. And in doing so, he was taken down. And that is not to defend anything that Nixon did, because surely what he did was not of high moral value, you might say. The methods he used were the methods that the intelligentsia use all the time, as evidenced by, Chomsky lays it out, as evidenced by the war on minorities that the government has waged. The FBI, I can't remember who it is that he referenced now, but the FBI made it a common occurrence that they would target young black men, especially men in the Black Panthers movement, which they called a dangerous and violent gang, which anyone who knows anything about the Black Panther movement, anyone who has been involved or who has known people that were involved back then and now in the Black Panther movement would know that that is the farthest thing from the truth when discussing the Black Panther movement. And maybe it's true that they were dangerous to the established elite, to the intelligentsia. And they were. Because they were preaching about self-defense. About arming yourself with knowledge and arming yourself with the proper tools to defend yourself against those that would do you harm. It's the same thing that you hear whenever they talk about gun legislation, like they are now, in fact. Gun legislation in the United States, and people saying, you can't take my guns, this is my constitutional right. Well, all the Black Panthers were saying in everything that they did, they were saying the exact same thing. You cannot take my ability to defend myself. And you know what they got for that? What they got for that was the FBI raiding them on a continual basis and murdering them. And it wasn't just the Black Panthers, it was... Now I wish I could remember the names of them all, but I can't. So it wasn't just them. Malcolm X was just a subject of such a raid. Well, not just, he was a subject of such a raid where they would get a floor plan or a schematic of where these people lived. They would know where they slept, and they would go, and they would open fire in the direction of where each of these young men were sleeping, and young women. We shouldn't be exclusionary here. They would open fire and murder them on purpose, because these people were, these people were a threat to them. They were a threat to the intelligentsia and the propaganda that the intelligentsia would have us all believe. And my own skepticism makes me think of the Breonna Taylor case more recently. It makes me wonder about that. It makes me wonder, was that also a targeted attack? Of course, I don't know. I assume it was. I mean, and maybe that's my own worldview, but it seems to me that it probably was. But that doesn't really mean anything, I suppose. What I think. I don't have proof like Chomsky did about the attacks on the Black Panthers and on all the other groups. But just this simple... But the point here is the simple fact that these people were targeted and killed for challenging the intelligentsia and the powers that be, or as Chomsky put it, men with power. Because as he put it, Watergate, the whole Watergate scandal, it eclipsed these attacks on... It was very conveniently eclipsing the attacks on these young black men. It eclipsed the exposure that I believe it was the FBI, the exposure that the FBI got for getting caught infiltrating the black community and distributing drugs amongst them, and then using that distribution as a means for a raid upon that community. They broke down the black community. The black community back, while nothing was perfect in any community, even back then, even before then, there were strengths, and there still are these strengths, but there were strengths back then that were obvious and obvious to see that the black community at large had, that were broken down, they were torn apart by the U.S. government and by the powers that be, by the intelligentsia. And this brings us back to Watergate, in a way. Because while what I left you with before, whenever we talked about Watergate, I hope I didn't lead you to think that Nixon was some sort of a hero attacking the intelligentsia, because he wasn't. It was, as Chomsky put it, men with power fighting men with, men of power fighting men of power. Nixon was just another one of the intelligentsia, just he wasn't on the right side of it, I guess. Or maybe he was just too hungry for the power. And it all ties together, because this was a perfect moment to eclipse all the horrible things that the FBI were doing and the ATF. All of them. The horrible, horrible things they were doing. And they used the moment to eclipse it. And what happened to Nixon? Did he go to prison? No. Many of the kids, many of the students that challenged the orthodox economics, that challenged the establishment in their universities, they went to prison. And many, many, many people in the black community went to prison for doing nothing but challenging the powers that be, or the men of power, as Chomsky puts it. But Nixon, he didn't go to jail. He didn't go to prison. No, because he was a man of power. He was one of them. He was just out of place, that's all, so he had to be taken down a notch. And I hope this paints a picture in your mind of sort of the struggle against these quote-unquote men of power, the struggle against the intelligentsia, the struggle against those that would hold us down with their form of state capitalism or state communism or state whatever-ism, state-ism, as we anarchists often describe it. And what we need to do, or I guess the call to action from Chomsky, is to continue to be a skeptic. Continue to be a skeptic of all the powers that be. Continue to be a skeptic and to challenge them, whether it is in words or challenge them out in the streets, to challenge the powers that be. And we can go on and on with examples. Examples of the police. Just the very structure of the police, for instance. And I am going to go on this tangent because now it's got me thinking. The very structure of the police. The hierarchical structure where they are they're the guard on the street that keeps the people in check. Your local police force, they are hired in and trained to keep you under control. You could be doing something as simple as, well, and I think we've talked about this before. I know in Kentucky this is still a law. You could be doing something as simple as putting a ice cream cone in your pocket. I know it's silly, but that is a law where if you have an ice cream cone in your pocket, you can be fined and go to jail because you've stepped out of line and done something that they said not to do. Or something more severe, protesting against a war, for instance. Maybe you want to go to your state capital and with a group of your friends and protest the continued war in Afghanistan. 20 years it's been waged. 20 years the United States has oppressed yet another nation and used that as a launching platform to oppress all of the nations around it in Afghanistan. 20 years. We're coming up on a 20-year anniversary in a couple of years here of the invasion of Iraq, and we are still, I shouldn't say we, the intelligentsia, the powers that be, the men of power, still occupy that nation and still infiltrate their society with their propaganda, with their pro-American propaganda, with their pro-empire propaganda. Still, we are in those countries. The longest wars the United States have ever waged. So, and if you go and challenge it, if you go and you protest it, especially now, say you fly out with a group of friends to Washington, D.C., you will be met by Capitol Police, by the guardsmen in this prison, by the guardsmen in this prison we call a free nation. You'll be met by them, and you will be taken off to jail if you persist. Now, perhaps they'll give you a warning. Perhaps they'll say, hey, 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 you can't film here. Hey, you can't be here without a permit. So you have to have a permit to protest something so evil as a war in a nation, a war in the nation of Afghanistan. A war that's been waged for 20 years on the minds of those people. If you want to protest, sure, you can protest, but you have to get a permit first. You can't just go out and express your frustration. And it's all about all of this. The fight against the Soviet Union back then, the fight against Russia and China now, that the United States wages. It's all men with power, or men of power, fighting men of power. Although, in today's day and age, it would be more appropriate to say it is all people of power fighting people of power. And we're just the pawns. We're just the cannon fodder that gets in the way sometimes. And this is what the fight against, or this is what we all fight against. But the fight all starts in the mind, because that's actually where the fight is being waged, where the war is being waged through means of Facebook and other mass media. It's all being waged in the mind. And if you can change your mind, if you can, or not just change your mind, but if you can free yourself in some small way of the influences of the intelligentsia, of the influences of the people of power, then maybe you can reclaim some small instance, some small portion of your own individuality and your own freedom. And if enough people do that, then maybe a society can be built around that idea of individual freedom, of mutualism. Maybe a society can be rebuilt from the ashes of a society that has been completely controlled in mind and body for hundreds of years, for thousands of years, for millennia, as it were, controlled by people of power, be it a religious organization like in ancient Egypt, or by the modern state, or by the modern social media company, or by the modern media company in general. And the goal is to free yourself in the end. Free yourself. And that kind of covers what I've read so far. If you've read more, I'm sorry I didn't get further into the book, but this is sort of kind of as far as I've gotten. I'm sure it gets more interesting, but this is one book that I really, really, and I wanted to do this with all books, but this book in particular, the way he describes things is so dense and complex. I wanted to cover an individual topic like this, although it sort of is embodied in everything that he said, this idea, the ideas that we've been talking about today. But this is as far as I've gotten so far. And that was about 6 pages of notes that I took. And no, I wasn't reading off of the notes the entire time, but and I skipped quite a few of my notes. If I had not, this would be a much longer audio clip. Right now, before editing, we are at about an hour, and I will be cutting out all the silences that I had throughout, and probably this very thing that I'm saying now. But this is this is sort of the beginning direction that Chomsky goes in this work. Language and Responsibility. And I imagine, though I've not read this one through all the way through yet, I imagine where he's going with this is to take responsibility for your own mind. But we'll see. I could be entirely wrong. So that'll wrap it up for this one. Next time, we are going to continue on with this work, Language and Responsibility. We will continue with Chapter 2, because I only have a couple pages left in the first chapter of this work. So we'll continue with Chapter 2 and see where we get from there. I have a strong amount of doubt and skepticism, as it were, that I will be able to get through the rest of the book in the next, well, let's just call it an episode, in the next episode. But maybe we will. Maybe I'll read through it and I'll take plenty of notes, but maybe I'll be able to get through the whole thing. So we'll just see. So that is our next week's homework. And also for this for the rest of this week and next week, find another way. If last week you found a way to free yourself of some sort of media, maybe this week you should seriously consider leaving Facebook if you haven't already, or leaving Twitter if you haven't already. Free your mind of the inputs of Twitter and Facebook. And come to Mastodon if you need an outlet. If you don't, that's fine. But I use Mastodon mainly for communication and posting new episodes of this podcast. But if you don't need it, then you don't need it. But try freeing your mind a bit. Maybe you can't delete your Facebook profile, but maybe stay off of it this whole week and just see what happens. See how your mind changes. I think that should be that, and read more of Language and Responsibility. I'm going to try to at least get through Chapter 2 and maybe finish the whole thing, but we'll see. So that is it, and thanks for reading.